content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Lonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 27th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has James Comey riding on a white horse, and both Comey and the horse are decked out in battle garb of medieval knights, armor and everything. Comey's got a lance pointing into the foreground, and he's got a shield that has Donald Trump with the circle and a line through it over it, the no Donald Trump symbol. And he's charging into the foreground, and the title is Comey's Crusade. Does his new book do more damage to Trump or to Comey himself? And we'll find out about that in the controversy of the week. But right now, we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump still wants out of Syria. What happened? President Trump signaled this week that he was sticking to his plan to withdraw all 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria in the coming months, after launching a limited set of missile strikes on the Syrian regime in response to a chemical weapons attack that killed more than 40 civilians in Douma. In joint pre-dawn mission with France and the UK last Saturday, the U.S. and its allies fired 105 Tomahawk and other missiles to destroy three facilities linked to the Syrian government's chemical weapons program to avoid provoking Russia, which along with Iran is backing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Pentagon avoided hitting any targets near Russian forces. The strike came only 10 days after Trump told the Joint Chiefs of Staff he wanted to remove all U.S. troops from Syria by the fall. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told senators this week that Trump remained set on extricating the U.S. from Syria, despite intense lobbying by senior administration officials and French President Emmanuel Macron. Administration officials are now seeking to form a coalition of Arab states to help replace American troops in eastern Syria and prevent ISIS from regrouping. Trump initially pushed for a more forceful response in Syria, largely because he'd sent a series of bellicose tweets promising Assad would pay a big price, but he was talked down by Mattis, the New York Times reported. In a televised address, the president urged Moscow and Tehran to drop their support for Assad and warned that the U.S. would launch further strikes if the, quote, monster dictator used chemical weapons again. On Twitter, Trump described the strikes as perfectly executed, adding, mission accomplished. He later angrily reversed an announcement by UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who said the military response would be coupled with new sanctions on Russian companies linked to Syria's chemical weapons program. The White House said Haley was confused and that no new sanctions would be imposed. What the editorial said. Trump was right to order the strike, said the Washington Post. It's vital that civilized nations uphold the international ban on these horrific weapons. But the mission is far from accomplished, and the president's determination to pull U.S. troops out of eastern Syria, is misguided. Arab nation forces would be no match for the Russian and Iranian-backed Assad regime and Turkey. The Turks would decimate the Kurdish troops who helped the U.S. defeat ISIS, and Tehran would obtain the land corridor it seeks across Syria, all but guaranteeing a catastrophic conflict between Iran and Israel. Limited strikes please neither isolationists nor hawks, said the Chicago Tribune. But unless the U.S. launches an Iraq's war-style intervention in Syria, something no sane American wants, the country's fate will ultimately be determined by Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Those countries have much more at stake and are thus willing to take greater risks to achieve their aims. The U.S. must accept its status as a marginal player. Trump's hasty reversal on sanctions is deeply suspicious, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Despite a litany of egregious transgressions by Russia, including Moscow's denial that the Assad regime used chemical weapons, he continues to advocate a good relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Could the once far-fetched notion that Trump is being blackmailed by Putin actually hold some truth? What the columnist said. Somewhere deep in his concrete labyrinth, Assad is smiling, said Dexter Filkins in NewYorker.com. He's paid only a small price for using chemical weapons to flush out the remaining resistance in Duma. Trump gave him time to move his warplanes to Russian bases and held back a truly punishing attack that would antagonize Moscow. Assad now knows Trump will never seek to force him from power, no matter how many Syrians he slaughters. Trump deserves credit for enforcing President Obama's infamous red line, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. But the airstrikes didn't hit a single airplane, airfield, or delivery system, leaving his air force intact. This weak response will not only leave Assad emboldened, it will also reassure North Korean leader Kim Jong-un that Trump's bellicose threats are empty. Actually, Trump appears to be embracing a sensible middle path, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. Rather than trying to impose a U.S.-led solution on a broken region, he wants only to ensure that neither Russia nor Iran becomes too dominant. When the balance of power is secure, he can keep his distance. When that balance is threatened, he can work with regional partners to rein in aggressors. This approach has a real chance of success, but only if this administration can learn to manage its alliances. The biggest worry is Trump's increasingly extreme mental state, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. On the day the president was supposedly mulling his options for Syria, he was angrily tweeting about the criminal investigation into his private lawyer, as well as the Russia investigation. Seething with rage and resentment, Trump is clearly allowing his emotions and what he sees on Fox News to distort his decision-making. This is deeply alarming. With major military decisions ahead on Iran and North Korea, we have a commander-in-chief who very clearly is not in command of himself. What next? The Trump plan to replace U.S. troops in Syria with Arab nation forces is highly problematic, said Alex Ward in Vox.com. Two of our most important would-be partners, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, are already overextended militarily in Yemen and thus unlikely to commit troops. Even if they did, most experts think their subpar militaries would struggle in a campaign against ISIS. Worse, that plan would pit the military forces of two mortal enemies now fighting for control of the region, Shiite Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia, directly against each other. That could provoke a dangerous and unnecessary escalation that could trigger a regional war. Controversy of the week, Comey, what his book actually reveals. This isn't the first time we've had to ask this question, said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. But is James Comey helping? When President Trump fired him as head of the FBI last May, Comey was already notorious for spotlight-grabbing intrusions into the 2016 presidential election that helped get Trump elected. Now here comes Comey again with a new memoir, A Higher Loyalty, and a barrage of media appearances in which he is hammering his contention that Trump is morally unfit to be president. Trump, Comey writes in his book, is a serial liar who inhabits a cocoon of alternative reality and runs his administration like a mafia boss, complete with loyalty oaths and an us versus them worldview. In an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, Comey stopped just short of accusing Trump of obstructing justice by interfering in the FBI's Russia investigation and said, "It's possible that Russian President Vladimir Putin has compromising information on Trump, perhaps even the infamous P-tape." To Trump's opponents, Comey's insider story helps flesh out the picture of the amoral, authoritarian president who's unfit to serve, aided this week by Trump's tyrannical Twitter rants about how Comey is a slime ball who should be sent to jail. But to Trump defenders, the former FBI director's clear personal animus only feeds into the narrative of a deep state conspiracy against the president. Comey's bitchy book torches what's left of his own reputation, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. While offering no new details about his interactions with Trump, this pompous ass actually admits he was driven by politics and poll numbers when he decided to announce, 11 days before the election, that the FBI was reopening its investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Since she seemed certain to win, Comey wanted to cover his own butt and prevent critics from saying voters didn't have the full truth. Now, in his crusade against Trump, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times, Comey even stoops to mocking Trump's hair, his hand size, and his fake orange complexion. By engaging in these personal insults, Comey surrenders the high ground, descends to Trump's level, and lets Trump once again get the better of him. It's far too late for Comey to convince liberals he's a hero, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. The lifelong Republican's clumsy and self-conscious interventions in the 2016 presidential race likely cost Clinton the election. After finding no reason to prosecute her for her use of a private email server, the FBI director broke with Justice Department rules and gratuitously criticized Clinton for being extremely careless in her handling of classified information. This public slap was an obvious attempt to appease angry Republicans. Meanwhile, Comey didn't tell voters about the FBI's far more serious investigation into the possibility Trump's campaign may have been getting aid from a hostile foreign power. What was Comey thinking? Comey may have feet of clay, said Harry Littman in the Los Angeles Times, but he has still performed a service with this book. In documenting Trump's pressure to clear him and his aides of Russian collusion, Comey has provided a highly credible account of possibly criminal behavior by the president. Trump's fate, however, will likely be decided in the court of public opinion, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. By lowering himself to Trump's sordid level and revealing such personal animosity, Comey has undermined his value as a witness in possible impeachment hearings. Once again, he is showing that his judgment is flawed. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for Samuel T. Taylor Coleridge. After a coffin containing the romantic poet's remains was discovered in a London wine cellar. You could see it as appropriate, commented Richard Coleridge, great-great-great-grandson of the hard-drinking author of Kubla Khan. It was a good week for close shaves when an asteroid nearly four times the size of one that leveled 500,000 acres of Siberian forest in 1908 missed Earth by only 119,500 miles last weekend. Startled astronomers had detected it less than a day earlier. And it was a good week for Louisiana's animals after the state Senate passed a bill banning bestiality. If you vote against this bill, good luck explaining it, said Senator J.P. Morrell. 10 senators then voted against it. But it was a bad week for Scott Pruitt when Congress's Government Accountability Office ruled that the scandal-plagued head of the Environmental Protection Agency violated the law when he installed a $43,000 soundproof phone booth in his office last year. It was a bad week for Henry David Thoreau after a new study found that the ecosystem of once pristine Walden Pond in Massachusetts has been devastated by anthropogenic nutrient inputs, that is, tourist swimmers peeing in the pond. And it was a bad week for taunting when Mexican-born boxer Francisco Vargas dominated and scored a technical knockout over Rod Salca, who wore trunks depicting a brick wall and the words America First. Vargas said his opponent's trunks provided some extra motivation. And before we go to the next piece, a boring but important item. Justices strike down deportation law. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch joined with the court's four liberal-leaning justices this week to strike down a federal immigration law that allowed immigrants to be deported for violent crimes, ruling the law was unconstitutionally vague. The defendant in Sessions versus DiMaia, James DiMaia, was born in the Philippines and became a permanent U.S. resident in 1992 when he was 13 years old. The government sought to deport him following burglary convictions in 2007 and 2009. But the justices ruled 5-4 that the law's definition of aggravated felony as any crime with a substantial risk of physical force was too broad to be applied consistently by the courts. Vague laws invite arbitrary power, Gorsuch wrote in his concurring opinion. And on the briefing page this week, we have Hungary's illiberal democracy. Viktor Orban is leading Hungary away from the rule of law and human rights, but with popular support. How? How has Orban changed Hungary? He is turning it into a crony capitalist state with what is effectively one-party rule. Viktor Orban's right-wing Fidesz party, which has had a supermajority in Hungary's parliament since sweeping into power in 2010, has changed the constitution and enacted stringent laws guaranteeing its dominance. Fidesz controls all branches of government, including the judiciary. It has gutted the independent press, with the media now dominated by outlets that overtly support Fidesz and Orban. Businesses that are close to the party or to Orban and his cronies get favorable contracts, while those that are not face punishing taxes and regulations. Authoritarian capitalism, said Hungarian economist Gabor Schering, is the new political economic model. The takeover caught the opposition and the European Union by surprise. Fidesz got just 53% of the vote in 2010, but quirks of seat distribution gave it a two-thirds majority, and it quickly exploited its position to remake the country. In a 2014 speech, Orban explained that his vision for Hungary was an illiberal democracy, citing strongman states such as Russia and Turkey as models. He is well on his way to achieving that goal. How did he do it? By exploiting nationalism and fear of foreigners. Orban used government funds to wage a massive propaganda campaign depicting Hungary as under assault by Muslim and other dark-skinned immigrants and by liberals in the EU bureaucracy in Brussels. The campaign was effective because Hungary has had a long history of foreign domination and just a few decades of experience with democracy, capitalism, and a free press. It was a communist state in the Soviet-dominated Warsaw Pact until 1989. Orban changed the constitution to have judges appointed by a single person instead of an all-party committee and replaced experienced judges with his apparatchiks. He passed media laws imposing heavy fines on any press outlet deemed biased against the government, silencing those voices. Local TV stations were bought up by friendly oligarchs. Meanwhile, Orban installed political cronies in once independent bodies such as the state auditors and state prosecutors' offices. Gerrymandering and biased electoral laws make it highly likely Fidesz majorities will continue. Do Hungarians approve of this? Mostly, yes. The election last week, giving Fidesz a third straight supermajority, had a strong turnout of 69%. The vote was free in that there were opposition candidates and ballots were counted correctly, although it was unfair because of regulations disfavoring other parties and the suppression of government criticism. Orban has succeeded in convincing Hungarians that only they can preserve Christianity in Europe from a rampaging horde of Muslim refugees, just as Hungary held the borders of Christendom against the Ottoman army in the 15th century, an image he invokes frequently. In service to this nationalist narrative, he has demonized Hungarian-American billionaire George Soros, who funds civil society groups across Eastern Europe and sealed Hungary off from the 2015 wave of more than 1 million migrants fleeing Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. How did he do that? Orban closed Hungary's border and built a 100-mile barbed wire fence he later electrified. A propaganda campaign ensued, warning that Muslim immigrants would bring crime and rape Christian women. After the EU struck a deal to resettle some of the migrants in each of the member countries, Hungary refused to accept its quota. More recently, the flow of migrants has stopped, yet Orban still used the threat of Muslim criminals as his main campaign theme. Before the election, television news repeatedly showed a video of 2017 terrorist attack in Stockholm, in which an Uzbek asylum seeker drove a bus into a crowd. Who are his allies? A fierce anti-communist during Hungary's Iron Curtain days, Orban now is pro-Russia and has eagerly courted Russia President Vladimir Putin. Last year, Russia was awarded a no-bid contract to expand Hungary's only nuclear plant, further cementing Russian control of Hungary's energy supply. Orban has also praised and endorsed President Donald Trump and cited Trump's America First nationalism as justification for his own nationalist policies. We have received permission from, if you like, the highest position in the world, Orban said. Orban's closest European ally is Poland's de facto leader, Jarosław Kaczynski, who is using Hungary as a model. Kaczynski is limiting free press freedom and politicizing the court system as Poland slides toward authoritarianism. What can the EU do? Theoretically, it could cut off transfers and subsidies to Hungary, some $6 billion a year, and suspend its voting rights. This nuclear option, though, would be vetoed by Poland, just as any penalty against Poland would be vetoed by Hungary. Though Orbán's authoritarianism has horrified the EU, it is at a loss over how to respond to his wholesale flouting of democratic norms and values. Former EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding said the EU is designed to help members become more open and free and doesn't have the adequate tools to punish members who seek the opposite. We never thought that someone would go the other way, Reding said. It was unthinkable. The Soros boogeyman. Liberal American financier and philanthropist George Soros has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in Hungary since 1989, financing educational and social projects, including Budapest's prestigious Central European University. Orbán sees this promotion of human rights and the rule of law as a threat and has demonized the Hungarian-born Soros, who is Jewish, in a propaganda campaign filled with anti-Semitic code words and stereotypes. Parliament has taken up a Stop Soros package of laws aimed at banning non-governmental organizations. And last week, a Hungarian magazine published 200 names of mercenaries, including journalists and members of Amnesty International and of anti-corruption watchdog Transparency International, who it said were trying to turn Hungary into an immigrant, non-Christian nation. We are fighting an enemy that is different from us, Orbán said. Not open but hiding, not straightforward but crafty, not honest but base. Does not believe in working, but speculates with money. Does not have its own homeland, but feels it owns the whole world. Time to take in a few of the best columns of the week. The first comes from the U.S., titled, The Crisis No One Is Facing. Republicans and Democrats have the same plan for the massive hole in the federal budget. Do nothing, said Robert Samuelson. The latest projections from the Congressional Budget Office are gruesome. Thanks to falling revenue from Republican tax cuts and a bipartisan spending binge, the deficit will leap to $1 trillion by 2020, with the federal government adding another $12.4 trillion to our $21 trillion national debt over the next 10 years. Exploding the deficit during a strong economy makes no sense and may lead to rising interest rates and at some unpredictable point to a collapse in the U.S. creditworthiness. Political expediency is to blame. It's more popular to increase spending and cut taxes than the opposite. Balancing the budget will require annual spending cuts and tax increases that add up to $1 trillion, an unpopular combination that neither party has the courage to support. Liberals don't want Medicare, Social Security, and other entitlements touched, even though they equal about 70% of federal spending. Conservatives refuse to countenance tax hikes, even though without them, spending cuts would be unacceptably severe. Eventually, the bill for this willful blindness will come due. This column comes from the United Kingdom. Time to eat American Frankenfood. Brexit is going to force Britons to be less picky about their food, said Sean O'Grady. Leaving the European Union and its massive common market means the UK will need to strike a free trade deal with the world's largest economy, the US. And America sure as hell isn't going to let us sell it our steel, Rolls Royces, and banking services if we don't take its chlorinated chicken and hormone-laced beef in return. Just look at the latest annual report setting out America's wish list with trade partners, including the EU. The U.S. wants to scrap all manner of restrictions, including many of our rules limiting pesticide use and requiring strict standards of animal welfare. It objects to the country of origin labeling regulations that tell consumers where meat comes from, probably out of fear that informed buyers would shun American products. And it wants to scrap the geographical protection system. So get ready for California champagne and Virginia prosciutto appearing on our supermarket shelves. The U.S. government even claims that cloning technology can improve livestock herds and presents no food safety issues. So post-Brexit, chances are you'll be shopping blind, unable to avoid genetically modified American cheddar, even if you wanted to. This one comes from Japan. You must wait your turn to have a baby. Women being discouraged from having children, that's the last thing you'd expect in a country suffering a steep demographic decline, said Mainichi Shimbun in an editorial. Yet in those Japanese workplaces where women make up most of the staff, that's exactly what's happening. Managers are telling female employees to wait their turn before having a baby. In one recent incident that caused a public outcry, an employee at a child care center who discovered she was pregnant was chided by her boss for selfishly breaking the rules. He had drawn up a strict schedule for female staff to take time off to give birth, and she had ruined it. In another incident, a 26-year-old working at a Tokyo cosmetics firm was told by a supervisor that she'd be allowed to have a child only after 10 years of employment. She was emailed a document mapping out the childbirth schedules with the warning that selfish behavior will be subject to punishment. Even when female employees aren't explicitly told to stick to a schedule, many put off getting pregnant so as not to cause trouble at work. Japan's fertility has been below the replacement rate since 1974, and our population is actually dropping. Businesses in most countries can find ways to accommodate pregnant staff. Why can't Japan? And we're going to take one more column this week, one of the business columns, titled America's Subscription Boom. Subscriptions are the hot new thing in business, said The Economist, seen by many executives as the holy grail of profitability for delivering a recurring stream of revenue. Amazon Prime, Netflix, and Spotify are a few of the best-known subscription-based businesses, and venture capital firms are pouring money into more, including companies that deliver meals, pills, or even fresh underpants. But a business model built around locking in customers has its limitations, and companies should take care before they jump on the bandwagon. Yes, subscriptions help firms better predict future revenues and build deeper relationships with customers. Technology has also made it easier to rent rather than own assets, such as cloud storage space. But the model has its drawbacks. Landing customers in the first place can be eye-wateringly expensive, with companies often having to either maintain artificially low prices or spend big on marketing. Subscribers can also be annoyingly disloyal and flee at the first post-promotion bump in prices. Finally, there's the issue of saturation. America's 118 million households already have more than 200 million subscriptions to online services. And the offerings, from streaming sites to razor delivery, will only multiply. A first sign of trouble could be that there are not enough Americans to satisfy them all. We'll be right back. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. Title this week, How Gun Culture Has Changed. As an avid hunter and devoted gun enthusiast, I'm rarely out of reach of a firearm, said David Joy. But I don't see any need for assault weapons designed for mass human slaughter. 2 weeks before Christmas, I had a 9mm pistol concealed in my waistband and a rifle with two 30-round magazines in the passenger seat beside me. I was driving down from the mountains to meet a fellow I didn't know at a Cracker Barrel off I-40 in the North Carolina foothills. He wanted to buy a Kel-Tec Sub 2000, and I had one for sale. Other than that, I didn't know him from Adam except for a few Facebook messages. We were both members of a Facebook group where people post pictures of firearms and buyers private message to ask questions and make offers. Sometimes cash, sometimes trade. I needed money to pay a buddy for an old 70s model Lark teardrop trailer, and that rifle wasn't doing anything but taking up space in the safe. What I was doing was perfectly legal. In North Carolina, long gun transfers by private sellers require no background checks. Likewise, it's perfectly legal to sell a handgun privately so long as the buyer has a purchase permit or a concealed carry license. But as I headed up the exit to the restaurant where we'd agreed to meet, I felt uneasy. I was within the law, but it didn't feel as if I should have been. He was backed into a space parallel to the dumpster, a black Ford F-250 with a covered bed, just as he'd described on Facebook Messenger. As I pulled in, he stepped out. He smiled, and I nodded. You can just leave it in the seat so we don't make anybody nervous, he said as I rolled down my window. There were families in rocking chairs in front of the restaurant. Customers were walking to their cars to get back on the road. I climbed out of my truck so he could look the rifle over while I counted the money he'd left on his seat. He was about my age, somewhere in his early to mid-30s, white guy with a thick beard. He spoke with a heavy southern accent, not much different from my own. Said he built houses for a living, and that was about all the small talk between us. He liked the rifle. I needed the cash. We shook hands, and off we went. There is rarely a moment when I'm not within reach of a firearm. When I lie down at night, there is an old single-shot New England Firearms Pardoner leaned against the headboard, a loaded Smith & Wesson M&P Shield pistol on the nightstand. When I sit on the couch to work on an essay or a novel, there is a CZ-75 pistol on the coffee table. When I go to town for groceries, one of those two pistols is concealed inside my waistband. Where I live in the mountains of North Carolina, I'm not alone. With fewer than a dozen guns in the safe, I wouldn't even be considered a gun nut. Most of my friends have concealed carry licenses and pistols on their person. If there are 10 of us in a room, there are most likely 10 loaded firearms. Probably more, with a few of us keeping backups in ankle holsters. Rarely do we mention that we carry. We don't touch the guns. They are unseen and unspoken of, but always there. I can't remember a time in my life when I wasn't around guns. When I was a kid, there was a gun rack hanging on the wall in the living room. My father kept a single-shot 410 and an old bolt-action 22 small game guns, though he didn't hunt anymore. I can remember the first time my father taught me to shoot a rifle, how he had me sit on the concrete driveway and use my knee for a rest, aiming for a cardboard target in a honeysuckle thicket across the road. I think I was 8 or 9. I pulled the stock in too high on my shoulder and craned my neck awkwardly to line up the iron sights. I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew the rules. Always assume a firearm is loaded. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Know your target and what's beyond it. I come from a country people whose culture was destroyed by bulldozers and buildings. My father's family settled in and around Charlotte in the late 1700s. As a child, I would ride around with my grandmother in her light blue Oldsmobile. Where Winn-Dixie's and Food Lion stood, she remembered fields where she worked tobacco and picked cotton. I grew up in a tiny holdout spot of country where I ran through a pasture of chest-high field grass to fish a farm pond most evenings, where just a mile down the road my uncle still kept a kennel of hounds to run rabbit each fall. Guns were often a bridge between father and son. But my dad didn't keep a .38 special on the bedside nightstand like my best friend's father down the street. I never walked into the house and found him cleaning and oiling a dozen pistols at the kitchen table the way I did with my next-door neighbor's dad. For my family, guns had always been a means of putting food on the table. My father never owned a handgun. He kept nothing for home defense. As soon as I arrived in Jackson County, I knew I'd never leave. 150 miles west of where I grew up, I found a community that reminded me of my grandmother, where folks still kept big gardens and canned the vegetables they grew. They still filled the freezer with meat taken by rod and rifle, trout and turkey, dove and deer, rabbit, bear, anything in season. I keep a close-knit group of friends here, most of whom are at least 20 years my senior. Our generational difference is erased by a shared passion for wilderness and time spent in the field with gun in hand. This past Christmas, one of the men I hunt with, a man we call son-in-law, handed down a Model 94 Winchester to his grandson. The grandson would be the fourth generation to hunt with that rifle. A few weeks later, the boy took that 30-30 lever action into the field and killed his first deer with it, the same as his uncle, his grandfather, and great-grandfather. Those types of things are rare now, even in places like Appalachia. I'm the youngest member of my hunting camp, me, 34, everyone else in their mid to late 60s, a few on up past 70. Among these men, there are centuries of experience gathered around the campfire each night. After more than 40 seasons in the same woods, they've come to know the land intimately. I killed my biggest deer to date on the 2nd of November from a tree one of those men sent me to. 15 feet up a hickory, I watched a tree line at the edge of a clear cut. I heard heavy footsteps and eased around the right side of the tree for a look, and there he stood. Just before the deer strolled behind a cedar sapling, I touched the trigger, and the .308 blew apart the morning. The buck stooped forward and sprinted, back legs driving him over the tangled ground. He made it 40 yards before he crashed. From my stand, I could just make out the white of his stomach through the brush. I watched his ribs rise with each breath, that breathing slowing, then gone. A few days later, I was driving back home from hunting camp in McCormick, South Carolina, with a head of that 8-point buck in a cooler in the truck bed, the rest of the deer hanging to age at the processor. On a long straightaway, I passed a state trooper driving in the opposite direction. In the rear view, I saw him slam on the brakes and make a U-turn in the middle of the road, blue lights flashing. I was running just under 60 in a 55 and didn't think there was any way he was pulling me over. The 9mm I always carried was loaded and concealed on my side. Until that moment, I'd never been pulled over while carrying a concealed weapon. I knew the protocol. I knew that what I was legally obligated to say, but I was nervous as hell as the trooper stepped out of his cruiser and approached the side of my truck. He was a young black man with braces on his teeth. He looked to be in his early 20s, had kind eyes, and was built like a linebacker. He asked for my license and registration, and I told him I needed to inform him that I had a concealed carry license and that there was a weapon on my person. He asked where was the gun located, and I told him roughly 4 o'clock. He asked if I could get to my wallet, and I told him the pistol was pretty close to my back pocket. There was a moment of hesitation when he considered what to do next. Then he told me to move slowly as I took my wallet from my pocket. When the trooper had my license and registration, he went to his cruiser. In a few minutes, he came back to the window and issued me a warning for speeding. I asked if there was anything I could have done differently to make him more comfortable when he first approached the truck. The trooper told me what I'd said was fine. He smiled and told me, "But this is South Carolina. Most every car I pull over has a gun." As I headed toward the mountains, all I could think about was Philando Castile, the young African-American man who had a permit to carry and was shot to death in his car in front of his girlfriend and her young daughter by a Minnesota policeman after notifying the officer that he had a weapon. All I could think about was how things might have been different if the situation was reversed and that young black state trooper with braces had been behind the wheel, a white trooper cautiously approaching the car. It was impossible not to recognize how gun culture reeks of privilege. Last summer, I drove back to Charlotte to visit my father for his birthday. While I was there, I went into a Cabela's store in Fort Mill, South Carolina, to buy him a new depth finder for his fishing boat. After I found what I was looking for, I headed across the store to see if there were any good deals on ammo. There were floor displays of AR-15s and probably 100 or more other rifles and shotguns for anyone to walk up and hold. I watched a kid about 8 or 9 pick up one of those ARs and shoulder it to the center of his chest. He held the gun awkwardly, cocked his head hard to the side, squeezed one eye closed to aim, and dry-fired the weapon. I watched two men, presumably his father and grandfather, smile and laugh, then break out their cell phones to snap a few pictures. Maybe it's how I was raised and the types of firearms my family kept, but the idea of owning a rifle designed for engaging human targets out to 600 meters just never interested me. I keep a Savage 10 in .308 to hunt whitetails and hogs. I have a CZ-920 that's absolute hell on the dove field. Then there are the weapons I keep for defense, the shotgun by the bed, the pistols, firearms whose sole purpose would be to take a human life if I were left with no other choice. My friends see no difference between the guns I own and their ARs. One or two of them rationalize assault weapons the same way I justify what sits by my bed. When I asked if those rifles are really the best option for home defense, they joke about the minute hand of the doomsday clock inching closer to midnight. They post Instagram photos of Sig Sauer MCXs and tactical vests loaded with extra magazines, their bug-out bags by the door as they wait for the end of the world. But a majority defend their ARs the same way I defend the guns I use for plinking and hunting. They say they own them because they're fun at the range and affordable to shoot. They use the rifles for punching paper, a few for shooting coyotes. Every weekend, they fire hundreds of rounds from custom rifles they've spent thousands of dollars building. They add bump stocks and echo triggers to increase rates of fire and step as close to Title II of the Federal Gun Control Act as legally possible. None of them sees a connection between the weapons they own and the shootings at Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Aurora, Orlando, Las Vegas, Parkland. They see mugshots of James Holmes, Omar Mateen, Stephen Paddock, Nicholas Cruz. Crazier than a shithouse rat, they say. If it hadn't been that rifle, he'd have done it with something else. They fear that what starts as an assault weapon ban will snowball into an attack on everything in the safe. I don't believe that politicians are going to ban ordinary guns or overturn the Second Amendment, but I understand their reasoning because I understand what's at stake. I think about that boy picking up that AR in Cabela's, and I'm torn between the culture I grew up with and how that culture has devolved. There are changes I know must come, and there is an unrelenting fear of what could be lost. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times magazine. Here's one of the health and science articles. A finger's point about migration. A roughly 90,000-year-old finger bone found in Saudi Arabia's Nafud Desert adds to mounting evidence that early human migration out of Africa was considerably more complicated than previously thought. The remains are the earliest Homo sapiens fossil discovered on the Arabian Peninsula and the oldest outside Africa and the Levant. Until relatively recently, most scientists believed that modern humans first left Africa in a single migration some 60,000 years ago. But along with other recent finds, including 80,000-year-old human teeth in China and tools dating back to 65,000 years in Australia, the finger bones suggest our ancestors actually left the continent much earlier in several different routes. There's a growing picture that this old model of single-rate expansion is inaccurate. The picture is changing. And we'll go right on to the talking points page. Paul Ryan, judging his term as House Speaker. It seems like ancient history now, but House Speaker Paul Ryan was once hailed as both the GOP's ideological standard-bearer and its future, said James Homan in the Washington Post. In 2015, the conservative policy wonk reluctantly bowed to pressure to take the Speaker's chair as the only member of Congress who could unite Republicans after a right-wing rebellion against John Boehner. But last week, the 48-year-old Ryan announced that he'd be joining Boehner in retirement, another casualty of his party's bitter factionalism. When he first became a national figure in the 2000s, Ryan portrayed himself as a small government, free market libertarian whose primary mission was reining in Washington spending and big government. Mitt Romney tapped Ryan as his running mate in 2012 to shore up his appeal with grassroots conservatives. Now the base has a different hero, the populist Trump, who has repudiated Ryan's positions on free trade, immigration, and reforming entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. Ryan has become a stranger of sorts in his own party. Good riddance, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Ryan has successfully sold himself as a serious policy guy and deficit hawk to a gullible media, but he's always been a phony. Under President George W. Bush, Ryan voted for multiple budget-busting tax cuts, costly wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the 2003 Medicare expansion, and the TARP bank bailout. During the Obama administration, Ryan proposed a long-term plan to reduce the deficit, but it relied on magic asterisks, such as unspecified spending cuts and wildly optimistic growth projections. Under Trump, Ryan did push through the one thing he cared about most, a tax cut for the rich and corporations. But even there, Ryan was a failure on his own terms, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker. The giveaway to the GOP's donors will add $1.9 trillion to the debt over 10 years, while making Democrats less likely than ever to cut benefits to retirees and the poor. Every time a Republican tries to bring up the debt or reforming Social Security and Medicare, this figure will be thrown in their faces, and rightly so. Ryan deserves some credit, said Mona Chirin in NationalReview.com. Nearly single-handedly, he managed to put out-of-control entitlement spending on the national agenda. Unfortunately, his reward for attempting to drag our country into a grown-up reckoning with our debt was to be caricatured by Democrats as the goon throwing Granny in her wheelchair off a cliff. The country is going to miss Speaker Ryan, said John Podhoretz in CommentaryMagazine.com. Whatever his failings, Ryan had a low-key approach to politics and a mastery of the details that have sadly gone out of fashion among Republicans in the age of Trump. If the House has become an inhospitable place for a Paul Ryan, who actually cared about national matters more pressing than his next Fox appearance, then woe betide us all. Spare me the tears, said Ronald Brownstein in the Atlantic.com. Over the past year, Ryan was Trump's most important enabler. Fully expecting that Trump would lose the election night in 2016, Ryan was prepared to give a speech denouncing Trumpism's racism and urging the GOP to return to a more inclusive message. Instead, when Trump won, Ryan folded the speech back into his jacket pocket. Since then, he's made a devil's bargain with Trump, choosing to look away from the president's crude, divisive rhetoric and contempt for democratic norms, in hopes of furthering his own priorities, especially the tax cut. History will not judge Ryan kindly, said Tim Alberta in Politico.com. He stood mutely by while Trump has attacked private citizens and corporations, attempted to delegitimize federal law enforcement, and committed innumerable other acts for which Barack Obama would have been impaled by the right. When it's asked how the party of fiscal sanity, family values, and compassionate conservative became the party of exploding deficit, Muslim bans, FBI hatred, and porn star payoffs, the answers will implicate not just Trump, but Ryan and other Republicans as well. The great tragedy of Paul Ryan is not that he sold his soul to Donald Trump. It's that he got so little in return. And we'll close with a quote from Kurt Vonnegut. He says, "A step backward after making a wrong turn is a step in the right direction." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.